This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, welcome to Washington Watch. Tony Perkins is taking some time off. This is Eben Fowler. I'm a director of operations for BOT Radio Network, and I have the privilege of sitting in for Tony this afternoon. We've got a great lineup for you today, some really interesting topics. We're going to start out talking about the Electoral College. Now, don't glaze over quite yet, because this is going to be interesting and important to know about, and I'll tell you why in just a minute. Our second segment, we'll be talking about a survey that George Barna did that talks about who had the most influence on conservative Christians this last election. And you will be, well, you won't be surprised with all of the entries in the top five, but you will be at least about one of them. We'll tell you about that coming up at about 22 after the hour. Then we're going to talk to Ryan Morrow, a security expert, about the some of the cabinet positions that President-elect Trump and his team are talking about some of those really important positions in the government that are going to dictate a lot of the policy that's going forward as we get into next year and the next 4 years, for that matter. Finally, kind of a tough topic in our last segment. We're going to be talking with Lieutenant Randy Sutton. He has an organization called Blue Lives Matter. And if you've been paying attention to the news this last day, unfortunately, there were a number of police officers who were wounded, one killed at least that we know of in San Antonio, Texas. We're going to talk to Randy about what his organization is doing and why, maybe some of the things we might be able to do to turn this around. So let's, first of all, jump into our first topic this afternoon, and that is the Electoral College. Suddenly, Democrats on the losing end of a presidential election have rediscovered an American institution that they now seem to loathe and want to get rid of, and that's the Electoral College. So we're going to talk to an expert on that topic. Now, think about this. This Thursday is Thanksgiving. Some of the family members we're going to get together with may not have voted the same way that we did, and so the topic may come up. Hopefully we can handle it gracefully and lovingly, but the topic of the Electoral College might come up, and I guarantee you these next few minutes are going to be educational. Let's pretend we're back in our high school civics class for just a minute. We're going to be talking with Tara Ross. She is the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College, and she knows a lot about this subject. Tara, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about your background and then also about this book that I just mentioned, Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College.
Well, sure. I am a retired lawyer. Some people would say I'm a recovering lawyer.
Yeah.
And I've written this book about the Electoral College. It came out, it's actually been out in two editions. This year I actually released a kid's book about the Electoral College called We Elect a President, the story of our Electoral College, and my fourth grader helped me with some sections of that book. Her job was to help me come up with modern real-life examples that would make sense to middle school kids. So and it's got beautiful illustrations done by a high school senior. We had a lot of fun. So I am just, for whatever reason, studying this for like the past 15 years, and I guess now that's turning out to be helpful.
All right. So tell us a little bit about the Electoral College. Where did it come from and why is it something that we really don't want to get rid of? And, you know, it depends on which side of an election you're on as to how you might feel about the Electoral College, right?
Well, you know, so one reason I started studying this institution in the first place, it was right after the 2000 election when George Bush, of course, had won the Electoral College vote and lost the popular vote. And what I noticed at the time, it's a fact that has gotten forgotten over the years, but what I noticed is that how easily this could flip. And the reason I noticed that is because Al Gore was actually making preparations in October of 2000 to defend what he thought was going to be his Electoral College victory and popular vote loss. Because the way the polls were coming out, it was looking like that might be the situation. So he had lawyers preparing memos, and he was getting ready for that. And then, of course, it turned out to be the complete opposite situation, and instead Republicans were the ones defending an Electoral College victory. And what I thought as I watched that is I thought, you know, this can flip so easily. And either this is a good institution or it's not. And we can't, our defense of it cannot rely upon whether we do or don't like the candidate that wins in a particular election year. So, you know, I happen to think, like I said, I've been studying this for a pretty long time. And what I have discovered is that this institution is badly misunderstood. It's never taught in our schools. Nobody has any idea why it exists. But it is an institution that serves all of us, Republican and Democrats alike. And yet, the Democrats, believe it or not, it is even serving them this year. But it's serving them by showing them that they've been making some mistakes and reaching out to a wide variety of people in recent years. And I really, really hope that they will take time to figure out why that was and to do a better job of reaching out to a better cross-section of Americans.
Now, essentially, and I read a great article last week in Investor's Business Daily, and they have fantastic editorials. This one was called Don't Trash the Electoral College, It Works. And I found it to be very educational and very enlightening. And explain, kind of get down in the weeds just a little bit. What are the Sure. practical reasons for the Electoral College? Why is it important that we maintain it?
I think the most important thing to know about our Electoral College and our Constitution in general is that the founders were not trying to create a pure democracy. We hear this all the time in the media, you know, that we are a democracy or that we're spreading democracy around the world. We're not. I mean, the founders, they were students of history, and they knew that if you create a pure democracy, okay, just unfiltered, simple majority rule, what happens is that those kinds of governments, as a matter of history, implode. And the reason they fall apart is because in a pure democracy, 51% can order the other 49% around all the time, no matter what. You can imagine in the wake of something like 9/11 and fear or bigotry or sadness or whatever, 51% could do anything to the other 49%. And so the founders knew, look, there has to be a better way. We do not want to create a government where a simple majority can tyrannize the rest of the country. And, of course, they knew from their own experiences, you know, they had fought the American Revolution because they had no representation in Parliament. But even if they had been given representation in Parliament, they would have been a minority, and they would have been outvoted time and time again by the majority of citizens at home in England. So they wanted to create a government that would be self-governing, that was important to them. You know, as I mentioned, they just fought the whole war over the ability to be represented in the government. On the other hand, they knew they needed checks and balances to provide safeguards for especially large minority groups, the small states, to make sure that they were protected and not tyrannized by an emotional bare majority.
Well, let's talk about that small states issue, because I think that's probably one of the most important things, at least, you know, from the article that I read that I gleaned. And that is, for instance, you know, if you were sitting watching, and I'm sure you were watching on election night, what was happening. And, we didn't know until it was getting later into the evening which way the election was going. But it looked at one point, you know, if you were listening to the talking heads on the networks, that, we may get to a situation where we have almost an equal number of electoral votes here. And it was looking like at one point, a very small state, and I think it may have been Maine, maybe New Hampshire, where, you know, a very small number of electoral votes, that one state potentially, in looking at the different scenarios, could have flipped the election one way or the other, correct?
Yeah, there were several scenarios where there would be a close outcome. And if that had happened, or you could have said if Evan McMullen had won Utah, maybe, as some thought he might for a while, and it held the other two candidates under 270, well, then what would happen is we would go to a House contingent election. And that, you know, that sounds scary to us, I guess, because we are not used to holding a House contingent election. The funny part is that the founders actually thought we would go to that House election most of the time. And they saw that as an important part of the compromise between the large and the small states. They thought that the large states would have an advantage in selecting the pool of candidates that would go to the House, but that once you got to the House, the small states would have the advantage in picking who the president was out of those three candidates. So in the House election, of course, each state gets one vote, and it takes a majority of states to win the election. So we didn't use that this year, but you're right. There were a couple couple of moments when it seemed like it might happen.
You know, and it seems one of the other points of the Electoral College is that it prevents the big states, and a lot of the big states have the large metropolitan areas with lots mm-hmm. and lots of votes. And what it seems to do is it helps to even out the balance. And one, again, one of the things that I gleaned from this article from Investor's Business Daily was that it means that the candidates can't just go to the big metropolitan areas, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Dallas, et cetera, and focus their campaigning there. They have to go everywhere because, yeah, they have to reach out to everybody, right?
And, you know, this is something that Electoral College proponents have been saying for years, is you've got to keep the Electoral College, because if you don't keep it, then what's going to happen is the candidates will just go to the big urban areas and they'll ignore everybody else. And often, you know, we'll say something like New York and California, LA, New York City, San Francisco, these are the places that will matter, and the rest of the country kind of won't. And people who don't like the Electoral College kind of poo-poo that and say it would never happen. Well, this year, it turns out that the reason that Hillary Clinton is winning in the popular vote is because, actually, I haven't looked in a couple of days, but the last time I saw it, it was something like 17% of her vote comes from just New York and California, two states. And if you take those votes away from her, then Donald Trump is winning by about 3.5 million votes. So it's such a good demonstration of this dynamic in action. It's precisely what we have always said would happen, is that those two densely populated states would end up controlling the election for everybody else. And that's not right. And that's exactly what the founders were trying to avoid.
Right. You know, and they had so much wisdom. I mean, how would they know that we would have these big metropolitan areas? Maybe they had sort of relatively big metropolitan areas back mm-hmm. then, and they looked at the landscape and said, you know, this is something that we need to be careful of. Well, let's talk we just have a couple of minutes left in this segment, Tara, but let's talk about the controversy a little bit. Activists apparently are circulating online petitions and using social media in hopes of influencing Republican electors to cast their ballots for somebody other than President-elect Donald Trump and deprive him of the 270 Electoral College votes he needs. I chatted with you a little bit earlier today, and we talked about that. What are your thoughts about that possibility?
So I think, as by way of background, it's just important for everybody to know that each candidate in a state, they have their own slate of electors. So I'm from Texas. There were 38 Republicans that were elected on November 8th. There was a different slate of 38 Democrats that could have been elected if Hillary Clinton had won in Texas. These are literally different groups of people. So on Election Day, we didn't just elect some kind of random group of people with no particular allegiance. We elected 306 nationwide, 306 Republican grassroots people to go serve their state. And we also elected 232 Democrats. So the petition that is asking these 306 Republicans to change their electoral votes to Hillary, like, it's just not going to happen. Why would 306 Republicans, 37 of them, why would 37 of them flip with Democrats? It's not going to happen.
Well,
there is,
Tara,
Tara,
we're just about out of time here. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day. Tara Ross, the author of Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College, telling us about the Electoral College. Well, coming up next, evangelical Christians turned out in huge numbers for the November 8th election. According to the Barna Group, there were a number of key leaders that helped get out that vote. We're going to tell you who those were in the next segment.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. A culture of death soon becomes the death of a nation. America is already guilty of murdering our own posterity while yet in the womb. The implications of this alone are staggering. We have long warned that this infatuation with death wouldn't stop there, but would call for the demise of the aged and handicapped as well. Murder is murder, regardless the name one gives it. Abortion, euthanasia, and now end-of-life options, or in actuality, physician-assisted suicide. Colorado voted astoundingly 2-1 in favor of death, not only overthrowing the Hippocratic Oath, which states, do no harm, but most importantly, the biblical worldview, which says life is sacred. When a nation embraces death, instead of grappling with it, the Grim Reaper moves boldly and with greater velocity. Protect all life or watch the death of a nation. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi, after Hurricane Katrina. And then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others. And that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we notice with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network, talking to you from the headquarters of Bot Radio Network in Kansas City, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. It's my honor to do so. Our next segment, we're going to talk about a survey of 3,000 conservative Christians who voted in the November 8th election. They found that in this survey that 5 media analysts had a lot of influence on people's thinking about the presidential race. One of those on the list is Family Research Council President Tony Perkins and host of this very program, Washington Watch. Joining us now is George Barna. His group conducted the survey. Welcome to Washington Watch, George.
Thank you, Evan. Good to be with you.
Good talking with you. I think I interviewed you several years back. You probably don't remember that, but it's great to have you on the broadcast today. I know they've been working hard to get you here. We've only got you for a few minutes, so we're going to have to talk fast. Tell us about the survey. The organization is the American Culture and Faith Institute, which I believe you head. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That's part of a group called United in Purpose. We work with Christian ministries around the country. But ACFI does research. This was a study that we did on election night. After people had voted, we wanted to find out more about their thinking. So we had all kinds of questions. But in this particular part of the survey, we were looking at trying to understand how did people get information about the election, what kind of media were they using, and who were the media personalities who had the greatest influence on their thinking about the election. And that's where, as you alluded to, Tony Perkins came up in the top 5 in terms of influence on the thinking of this particular group that we were studying, which is a group called SAGECONS, which stands for Spiritually Active Governance Engaged Conservatives. In other words, people who are really devoted to their Christian faith. Because of that faith, they believe that they need to be involved in understanding and engaging in politics, because that's one of many ways they could influence the world. And so with that particular group, Tony did really well.
And I think those are the kinds of people who listen to this very program, I would assume. These are Christians who are concerned about what's going on in their country, and so they pay attention to what's going on in the public policy side of things and in government. Would that be a correct description?
Yeah, very much so. And you know, this is a group that voted overwhelmingly for Mr. Trump. One of the things that we found in the study was that if you look at all the different segments across the country and look at the levels of support that Mr. Trump got from all those different segments, the SAGECON group actually was the most supportive group of them all. And so when you read these news reports about how Christian conservatives made a difference in the election. I mean, we've got the numbers here to show that, yeah, they probably more than any other group united behind Mr. Trump, not so much because of his character, but primarily because of their concern about the Supreme Court and abortion and a couple of other issues.
That's right. Well, tell us who the other four were. You're talking about the top five. Who were the other four?
Well, at the top of the list was Rush Limbaugh. Behind him was Sean Hannity. Then was Bill O'Reilly. Then Laura Ingraham.
And so tell us about why you think particularly Tony Perkins was influential in this particular group of folks.
Well, we did some deeper digging to try to figure out what kind of people follow each of these media leaders. And we found that Tony does a very good job at attracting people who are very conservative, not those who are kind of on the edge of conservatism, but those who are really committed in social issues, in governance issues, in fiscal issues, the ones who say, yeah, I have an ideology, a political ideology, and it's very conservative in those areas. Those are the ones that tend to appreciate the kind of information that Tony delivers on this show.
And then there's one big difference between Tony and the other four. Would you like to point that out in terms of the fact that he's not a full-time media guy?
Oh, okay, yeah. I was going to say, boy, I don't know. I don't want to get too political here, but yeah. I mean, when we look at all of the individuals on that list, I mean, what you find is that generally the people on the list are full-time media personalities, and you find that they typically have both a television presence and a radio presence. So on average, these people would probably be broadcasting, either through radio or television, 16 to 20 hours, every week. And so that's a big difference from Tony. He doesn't have nearly that level of exposure. But also, he's involved in many other ministry ventures. He's, kind of at the grassroots level doing a lot of work to help so many people around the country. So that's different than people like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. I'm not saying one is better or worse. I'm simply saying it's a significant difference. And so I think that makes Tony's presence on this list that high up the list, because we looked at, over 40 different media personalities. So for him to be up that high on the list, I mean, that's really something.
Well, tell us a little bit more about these 3,000 folks that you surveyed, and maybe get into, we just have a couple of minutes left here, but get into some of the types of questions you asked them.
Well, we looked at a lot of different things about their lifestyles and their attitudes and who they were going to vote for, why they were going to vote that way, what they did in the election. We discovered all kinds of things. I mean, we found that, most of the Christian conservatives, the people that we were studying, most of them actually used voter guides. That distinguishes them from the rest of the population. When you read the news reports that say Americans typically are uninformed when they vote, they go in, they look at the names, and they say, oh, that's a nice name, I'll vote for that guy. Well, that's not how Christian conservatives do it. What we found is that more than three-quarters of them used a variety of voter guides to help them figure out who to vote for. We found that almost 7 out of 10 of them had spent time talking to other people who they knew were going to vote differently to try to convince them to vote the way that they were going to vote. We found that 4 out of 10 of them donated to one or more campaigns during the course of the 2016 election. And almost 3 out of 10 of them have been active in trying to get unregistered people to register to vote. As I mentioned, these people, voted, an incredibly high turnout rate. Again, probably the highest turnout rate of any segment in the country, and 94% of them voted for Donald Trump. The key issues to them, as I mentioned, were abortion and the Supreme Court. And, as they looked at all the different kind of scandals that the media were focused on, the ones that made the biggest difference in terms of how they chose to vote, number one on the list was Mrs. Clinton's support for abortion at any time, and the second one was her unfortunate use of a private server for her emails.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. George, thanks so much for joining us. George Barna with the American Culture and Faith Institute. We'll be right back after this break.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, we've got a little bit of economic data coming out on this shortened week. Existing home sales come out tomorrow. The big number for the week, though, is going to be durable good orders. Durable good orders, ex transportation, is the number that we watch. And that'll be out on Wednesday. New home sales as well as existing home sales. And we get the Michigan sentiment number that'll also be out later in the week. So they're important numbers. Durable goods, though, is the one we want to watch, see if we're seeing any improvement as we head into a very important time of year for even durable good orders as we head into the Christmas season. Stock futures are looking like a little bit flat. Federal Reserve looking like they're going to raise interest rates. I think that has little to do with the markets. I believe the Federal Reserve has just become a little bit more irrelevant than they already are. Interest rates having little impact on the market because most of the traders understand that Donald Trump has already pulled the punch bowl away. So interest rates mean little right now as far as the markets go. We are seeing the dollar beginning to rise a little bit again against the yen. Asia stocks are doing well. The interesting part about Asia stocks, yes, there is some good news from Japan in that their economy grew at an annualized rate of 2.2%, but they are suffering from the 13th consecutive drop in exports, and that's what they make their living on, is exports, down 10.3%.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Well, we're getting an idea of President-elect Trump's cabinet and policy positions. We're going to be talking about that in this next segment. Here to help us to sort it out is Ryan Morrow. He's a professor at Liberty University and a national security analyst at the Clarion Project. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
That's good to have you. First of all, what is the Clarion Project? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. We're basically an educational organization that focuses on Islamist extremism while also reaching out to Muslim voices of moderation so that we can ally with them as well.
Well, tell us what you think about the picks so far. I mean, he's not too far down the road in terms of having publicly announced the positions, but I'm sure, and in fact, I heard this morning that they're going to have everything pretty well put together between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and they're ahead of schedule, despite what the some in the media might be saying. But what do you think about some of the early picks?
Well, I'm impressed by the speed, and that's probably because Donald Trump supposedly sleeps like 3 or 4 hours a night, and that's it. And I guess you're seeing the fruits of that. But I like who he's chosen so far. The key takeaway for me is that the common denominator between four of them is that they all want to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist organization. And the reason that's so important is that the Brotherhood forms the radical Islamic infrastructure within the United States, the ones that are constantly shouting Islamophobia at anyone that speaks against them or that they disagree with. And it is from that radical foundation that you get supporters of Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS, even if they aren't Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is the starting point. They give the basic worldview.
Just another quick question about the Clarion Project. When did it begin, and how did you get involved in it? Then we're going to jump to some of the top challenges that you see in terms of this upcoming administration.
Sure. Well, the Clarion Project began in 2006, I believe. And the first film that they came out was Obsession, which most of your listeners have probably seen, about radical Islam. And then they released the third, Jihad, Iranium, and most recently, Honor Diaries. I've been with them for about 5 years now. And it was because of the films and the more intellectual tone that they took in their material that really attracted me to them. And so we united, and I've been a very happy camper since.
Very good. All right. We talked earlier today about some of the top challenges that you see, and let's run through those. Let me start with the first one, picking the right people for the cabinet.
Right, because Donald Trump, and I think you would admit this, doesn't really have vast national security and foreign policy experience. There are contradictions in what he says, and there have been things they've said that are just flat out incorrect. And so it's important that he relies upon the right advisors. And if he's going to advocate a policy of extreme vetting of those coming to the United States and who we ally with, well, then you also need extreme vetting of the vetters. You have to have the right people with very good backgrounds in order to do that, that understand how to detect the ideology. And so far, he's had good picks, ones that understand that it's not just about Al-Qaeda and ISIS, that there are other things like anti-Semitism, theocratic worldviews, that should be a disqualifier for who comes into the United States and who you ally with. But I did have concerns about some of the names being floated around, still being floated around, such as Governor Chris Christie, who does not have a strong record when it comes to radical Islam broadly.
The next item up is the Iran deal. Now, you know, during the campaign, Donald Trump referred to it as the, I can't tell exactly what he said, but he said it was one of the worst deals that's ever been put together. What's your view on the, give us a little quick breakdown on the Iran deal, where it is, where it should go in your view?
Well, right now we're at the point where Iran is getting a lot of money that goes right into the hands of the regime, not the people. So the regime is getting richer. And when they get richer, because of companies coming into Iran that previously weren't allowed to, that creates a bind between Iran and our allies that we would need in the future. So it makes them sanctions-proof in the future. So one of my arguments has been that even if Iran complies with the deal, it actually makes it more likely they'll get nuclear weapons and emerge stronger in numerous areas, financially, geopolitically, however you look at it. So I want the deal gone. And Donald Trump has moved back and forth between saying that he'll better police it, make sure Iran complies with it, or scrap it. And as of right now, we're not really sure where he's going to come down on that. But it's very important that he starts planning for Iran deciding, hey, if this deal's going to be done, then I better just start running at lightning speed towards a nuclear weapon now, because President Obama will not bomb the nuclear facilities. And if you're going to go for the nuclear weapon, it's best to do it right in the beginning of Donald Trump's presidency when he's less likely to take that military option.
That's right. Number three on your list, and by the way, we already did touch on number five, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. But number three is ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We're hearing a lot about the destruction of ISIS, but is the loss of ISIS a gain for Al-Qaeda? How do those two work together?
Again, this goes back to the ideological foundation. We keep hearing about ISIS, but we're not hearing about Al-Qaeda growing in places like Yemen and especially Syria. And so while we can cheer the news of ISIS's decline, which is very real in Iraq and Syria, those that leave the group and those that are left behind, some of which are very proficient in areas of technology and command and control and terrorism, are going to be absorbed by another group, because they didn't leave the broader ideology, and they'll be absorbed by Al-Qaeda, and maybe another group will rise up.
That's right. In 30 seconds now, tell me about the last number four, ideological warfare. Explain what that is very quickly, if you would.
Sure. How do you reach out to Muslim reformers like those that we work with at the Clarion Project, and will they be willing to work with a President Trump? And that's something you have to think about now.
Very good. Ryan Morrow, security expert, professor at Liberty University, national security analyst at the Clarion Project. Thanks for taking time out today to talk with our listeners. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, next segment coming up. The war on police continues with four attacks on officers over the weekend. Lieutenant Randy Sutton with Blue Lives Matter will join us to talk about the violence, and it'll also be an opportunity for you to get online and ask him some questions. The number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Get online, get on hold, and we'll talk to you in a minute.
Hey, our Holy Land tour in March is filling up. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We only go one time a year to Israel, and that's in March, and our tour leaves the 9th and gets back on the 17th. And as I say, we don't have a whole lot of space left on this tour. So if you'd like to go with us and see the Holy Land, you need to give us a call at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, with an S, option 5, and leave us your name and your address. We'll send you a brochure, or go online at twholyland.com, twholyland.com. Again, we're going to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Jericho and Nazareth and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River, all those places and much, much more. So join us on this very special tour of Israel in March.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Hello, this is Carol Cimbala, the director of the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. Here's your invitation to join us for our Thanksgiving radio special. You will hear a life-changing story of what happens when a person believes that with God, all things are possible. I've picked some of my favorite selections from the choir's latest CD, Pray. And my husband, Pastor Jim Cimbala, will present his Thanksgiving message. Don't miss this year's Thanksgiving special, Thanksgiving Day at 10 a.m. Central on American Family Radio.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger, a group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in today, gladly, for Tony Perkins, who's taking a little bit of a break going into the holidays here. Our last segment is kind of a tough topic. We're going to be talking about attacks on cops, what's been going on around the country for months now. As a matter of fact, if you've been paying attention to the news, Detective Benjamin Marconi was shot to death execution style in San Antonio while writing a traffic ticket not far from police headquarters. In St. Louis, a police sergeant was wounded when he, too, was ambushed. And in Gladstone, Missouri, just north of where I'm sitting right now, a traffic stop led to an officer there being shot along with the suspected gunman. And finally, in Sanibel, Florida, another police officer came under fire yesterday. Well, we're going to be this has been going on way, way too long. My guest knows all about it. He's Lieutenant Randy Sutton. His police career spanned three decades when he retired as a field lieutenant with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. To this day, he remains recognized as one of the most highly decorated officers in department history, with numerous awards for life-saving, exemplary service, and valor. And he is also involved in an organization that we're going to find out about called Blue Lives Matter. Thanks so much, Randy, for being on the broadcast with us today.
Oh, Evan, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, well, tell us about Blue Lives Matter. Tell us about the organization.
Blue Lives Matter is a grassroots organization of police officers, their families, and those who support the American law enforcement officer. We came about as a way to combat the false narrative that has been placed out there by liberal groups such as Black Lives Matter, MoveOn.org, and also a very, very biased media, which has shown a propensity to give a false narrative about law enforcement shooting. So, We began this as a grassroots effort, and now we have 1.2 million followers on, and we have a website, bluelivesmatter.blue, which gets anywhere between 7 and 10 million hits a month that gives out the news the way the news about law enforcement that is the truth. And that's what we do.
I want to make sure our listeners got that address. It's bluelivesmatter.blue, B-L-U-E, like the color. So write that down and check that out and get the information firsthand from folks who know about it. You know, in the midst of this, the tragedy that has happened over this past week, and I have some kind of good news to report that just came across the wire. San Antonio San Antonio, Texas media is now reporting that there is a suspect in custody in the murder of Detective Benjamin Marconi.
I didn't hear that. I'm so glad that you just told me that.
Yep. Yes, there's going to be a press conference coming up in just about 30 minutes. So that's a good thing. We were going to actually play an audio clip from the chief of police in San Antonio with a description of the suspect in the vehicle in case any of our listeners happen to be in that area. But fortunately, that's been taken care of. They don't know if it is the suspect, but they do have a suspect in custody. So, that's a little bit of good news amidst the bad news. Well, tell us a little bit about, I think we can probably trace this back somewhere to around what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. Am I accurate in saying that? Or what are your thoughts about where this all started?
Yeah, there were two incidents which gave rise to the Black Lives Matter movement. And one was the shooting of Trayvon Martin. And the other was the Ferguson debacle, where Darren Wilson was forced to kill the suspect in a robbery, and that gave birth to this aberration, which is called Black Lives Matter. And just for a little bit of history, so your listeners understand what Black Lives Matter truly is, it was started by three Marxist women in the San Francisco area whose unabashed philosophy is an anti-American anarchist viewpoint. And they have been espousing that for a long period of time, but they used this as the catalyst in order to foment their movement. And unfortunately, the complicit media has jumped on this bandwagon, as did George Soros, who has been funding it to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. So, that's how they've gotten their narrative out so effectively, even though it's a pack of lies. I mean, when Trayvon Martin, this is a perfect example. Somehow the police got blamed for Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin tried to beat a guy who was a neighborhood watch guy, Zimmerman.
Yeah, George Zimmerman.
And Zimmerman defended himself and killed Trayvon Martin. Somehow, that got put on the police. The police had nothing to do with it. And to the point where the president even comes out there and sticks his nose in it, saying, if I had a son, he'd look like him. And the false narrative about this innocent child, and of course, the media, puts his photograph from when he was in middle school, and the fact of the matter is, this kid was a born thug. That's what he was. He was a dope user. He was violent, and he attacked the wrong guy, and he wound up dying as a result of it. But somehow that got turned around, and gave birth to this the seeds of this movement, which then when Ferguson took place, that just pushed that narrative out to the point of idiocy with the made up mantra of "hands up, don't shoot," which, even though it was proven time and time and time again that it never occurred, somehow became the mantra of this movement where you saw celebrities and Congress people and everybody else doing this ridiculous hands up, don't shoot dance and talking about how the police gunned down this poor young man, which, of course, was found to be completely false.
Randy, I want to ask you a question about use of force here in just a moment. But first, I want to give our listeners an opportunity to call in and perhaps get online with you if they want to ask questions. The number is 866-372-7234. That's 866-372-7234. Randy, of course, use of force is a badly misunderstood concept, I think, among those who are outside of law enforcement, and it helps to drive a false narrative. Let's talk about Ferguson for just a moment. Michael Brown was a very large young man, and I'm going to ask you maybe to break this down and explain it just a little bit more. But they kept referring to him as an unarmed black teenager. The point is, you know, he wasn't carrying a firearm, he wasn't carrying a knife, but he weighed about 380 pounds, and he was charging a police officer who had given him a lawful order. The only way, as I've told people, that this police officer could have avoided this altercation was to have not done his job. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. But even actually, it goes a little more beyond that. Before he charged the officer when he was finally shot and killed, he was trying to wrestle the gun away from the police officer. And so when you get this misnomer about he was an unarmed youth, when there's a weapon present, that possession of that weapon can change in a heartbeat. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to take that officer's gun. And he wasn't going to try and take an officer's gun in order to go target shooting. He was going to kill that officer. And he attacked him. He punched him so hard he broke his orbital eye bone, the bone
the
eye around
socket.
His eye.
Right.
And he did a major amount of damage to the officer. He physically attacked him. And the officer defended himself because that's what cops do. If you try and hurt a police officer, you try and kill a police officer, they better kill you first because their lives are more valuable than that of a thug who is trying to take their life. And that's the reality. And it's not politically correct to say, but I'm here to tell you that as a police officer for 34 years, if you try and hurt me, I'm going to hurt you first. If you try and kill me, I'm going to kill you first. And that is the reality of policing.
Well, it's absolutely right. And it seems there's just and you mentioned the word anarchy, and you mentioned the perhaps the background of some of the founders of Black Lives Matter. But it is anarchy. It is a tremendous loss of respect for authority, and it's actually quite frightening. This is not a game. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And there, if you look at the demands, and that's exactly what the word is, the demands of this movement, they are to dismantle policing in America as we know it. They want no prisons, they want no police, and they want to substitute it with community organizations. I mean, it's so idiotic. It doesn't even make any sense. But they shout it, and the media gives them voice, and the president invites them to the White House to come hang out with them. So you know, it gives them legitimacy and empowers them. So they are so empowered that they march down the street and they scream, "What do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them now?" And pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon. And then people absorb that ideology. They riot in the streets. They burn. They loot. They kill. And who gets blamed for it? The police. It's utter madness.
Well, Randy, we've got a caller on the line, John from Kansas, who'd like to ask a question about Blue Lives Matter. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
How's it going?
Doing fine. John, what's your question?
I guess my question is, it's not so much a question. I want to offer just a microscopic alternate perspective, if I could.
Go right ahead.
Particularly, let me give you a little bit of background on myself. I'm an African-American male. My entire family is white. I'm adopted. And it's something to where I feel like I've been placed in the middle of two different things because of who I am and what I look like on the outside versus who I am and who the people I love and how they look on the outside and how I feel like I've been pulled in two different directions. Particularly in the sense of regarding the idea that, because I actually tuned into the radio station at the time you were posting or commenting on Trayvon Martin, particularly with how that you said it started with a full-grown man attacking a neighborhood watch person. In particularly from my perspective, being black, it's such that I get treated a different way because of the way that I look. And I'm not saying that's something on officers or any particular group, it's a reality that leads to the fact that one of the biggest things that was in contention with the George Zimmerman case was the fact that the 911 operator that he called told him not to engage with Trayvon while he was following him down the street.
Okay, John, I'd like to give Randy an opportunity to comment on that. Thanks for your call. Randy, would you like to comment on what John had to say there?
Sure. Let me tell you, I'm not saying that George Zimmerman handled the situation the way he should have handled the situation. And he actually did disengage when he was told to. And he was actually walking back when Trayvon Martin circled around, and then he began stalking George Zimmerman. So it went from Zimmerman following Trayvon Martin to him disengaging, and then Martin circling around and confronting Zimmerman. So that's what took place there, and then the physical altercation that where Zimmerman was getting his head smashed into the sidewalk and defended himself. But could that have been handled in a different way by Zimmerman? I believe
certainly
it could have.
Absolutely.
But when it comes down to the actual point of a physical attack, then you have a right to defend yourself. But you know, I sympathize with the caller, because I understand that he's placed in a difficult situation. I had many guests on my radio show, Police Radio, the Voice of American Law Enforcement, both black citizens and black officers, and they do face a certain stigma, and they are torn between loyalties sometimes of from the people that they their social group and the people that they support. So I understand his plight, and I sympathize with it. And when it comes down to it, you have to do the right thing. You have to, you know, the law enforcement officers that are serving this country couldn't care less about someone's race. More police officers have died in the line of duty this year, been murdered in the line of duty, than last year, to the point where we're almost at 80% difference. And many of those officers are black, and many of those officers gave their lives serving the black community. Having worked a beat that was predominantly African American in Las Vegas, I came to realize something, that most of the people in the black community trust and respect law enforcement and want the police there, because it's not the color of the skin, it's the character of the person.
Content of the character.
There's a great deal of gang predominance that occurs in minority areas, and they need to be protected from the people that live there, are forced to live in these gang infested areas. They want the police there, and the police are eager to serve, and that's the reality. But it's a reality that is not often told.
Well, Randy, in about 30 seconds, what do you think is going to change this? I mean, I know you don't have the solution at the palm of your hand, but tell us, what kinds of things do you think need to change? About 30 seconds.
I think that with President Trump taking office, I think there's going to be a game changer here. I think we're going to start seeing a Department of Justice that supports law enforcement and focuses on crime instead of police, which is what needs to happen. And police training needs to improve. And also benefits and salaries need to improve in order to attract the best people.
Lieutenant Randy Sutton with Blue Lives Matter, thanks for joining us on Washington Watch today. And this has been a great opportunity, great program. I want to thank our engineer Brent Creeley, the call screener Jonathan Coker, and our producer Russ Jones.
Or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.